Welcome to Disinformation Wars, a project of the American Foreign Policy Council. I'm AFPC Senior Vice President Ilan Berman. Disinformation Wars is a series of conversations with officials, experts, and practitioners designed to take you behind the scenes of the struggle for hearts and minds of global publics that's now taking place around the world. It's a contest being waged by Russia, China, Iran, and other actors, and the stakes could not be any higher.
How popular is Vladimir Putin's latest military adventure? In the West, the response to the Kremlin's current offensive against Ukraine has been near universal condemnation. In Russia, however, the story is very different. There, isolation from Western media and a steady diet of official propaganda has helped to keep support for Putin and his foreign policy agenda high, extremely high. According to two surveys carried out by a group of independent sociologists last month, nearly three quarters of Russians support the current war in Ukraine and expressed such positive emotions as pride, joy, respect, trust, and hope in their country's leadership. Of course, it needs to be said that polling in Russia is notoriously tricky. There, like in other authoritarian societies, citizens understand very well that there's only one way to answer a question about the government that won't get you into any trouble, and that is to praise it. Even so, those figures I cited suggest that there's a profound gap in perceptions between Russia and the West about the conflict itself, about Russia's objectives in it, and whether or not the war is, in fact, a just war. The reasons have everything to do with a war of narratives that's taking place over Ukraine. While here in the West, we are watching coverage of war crimes, military aggression, and indiscriminate brutality, that's not what Russians are seeing. There, Russian media outlets are depicting a fight by brave Russian soldiers against a fascist government, a military buildup by a West that is determined to see Russia diminished, if not destroyed outright, and a Russian government that is acting as a liberator of oppressed peoples. This gap has tremendous implications for the political environment within Russia itself and for how Russia will relate to the rest of the world after the current war ends, because every war must. I wanted to explore those themes with my guest for this episode. Cliff May is the founder and president of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, or FDD. FDD is a nonpartisan policy institute focusing on national security and one of the most influential voices in DC on issues like Iran, terrorism, and U.S. defense policy. Cliff is also a veteran news reporter, journalist, and editor, having worked at the New York Times and many other publications. He has covered stories around the world, including datelines from Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Israel, Nigeria, Mexico, Hungary, and, most significant for our purposes, from Russia itself. Cliff, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ilan. Great to be with you.
Let's start with that war of narratives I mentioned. You speak Russian, and you've seen your fair share of Russian television coverage since the war broke out in late February. What are Russian pundits, what are their talking heads, and what are their commentators saying about us, about Ukraine, and about what might be next?
Well, of course, essentially, their line, and they've been, I think, sticking to it, is that Ukraine is not a real country. This, you'll recall, was the subject of a very long essay that Vladimir Putin published and certainly distributed within Russia back in July. Ukraine is a kind of a rogue province, and it's ruled by Nazis or neo-Nazis, and that the Ukrainians would love to be liberated by Mother Russia. Now, I think that's a harder case to make, but that doesn't mean he and those in the media in Russia don't have to make it. And keep in mind that there was not a lot, but a fair amount of independent media, even a few months ago, and much of that has now been shut down. So what the Russians are hearing, I think, in TV and radio and from the official sources is this fiction? And now the question, of course, the next question is, do they believe it?
It's worth noting that they're saying all of this without being challenged in any substantive way. In the polls I cited in my introduction, three quarters of respondents, the same proportion that had positive views about the Russian government's actions, said they got their news from state news sources. By contrast, those who received Western news obtained via the use of tools like virtual private networks was just 5.5%. In other words, despite what we may think, Russians simply aren't accessing Western media. What does that mean as a practical matter, do you think? How does it play into Putin's popularity and the sustainability of his government's war effort overall?
You know, it's hard to tell. Obviously, there's polling, but of course, the polling is suspicious. There used to be other ways for Russians to get information from outside. I'm old enough to remember when people secretly and quietly turned on their shortwave radios and you know, I think it was either the Voice of America or Radio Liberty, the in sound from the outside. I remember people talking about it. There's two other important things to recognize here. One is that I think there probably is a lot of distrust of official media. There certainly was when I was an exchange student over there. I can remember friends of mine, they were sort of, I would call them dissident lights. In other words, they didn't like the government, but they didn't really want to be sitting in Siberia either. So they were careful, but not overly careful. They would say, look, nobody believes the lies of this government. Nobody believes anything about the Soviet Union or communism. And I think that was probably an exaggeration, but I think they spoke for a reasonably large cohort. At the same time, there's also this important point. And that is, before the fall of the Soviet Union, Russia had never been a nation state. It had always been an empire. Really, the Soviet Union was just a rebranding of the Russian Empire. Perhaps every possession of the Russian Empire was included in the Soviet Union and more. And I think there is kind of a nostalgia for empire. I think there is a kind of resentment that Russia is now to be nothing more than another European or Eurasian nation state, and not a particularly successful one at that, if you look at such measures as its economic successes. So I think there may be some belief that, yeah, Putin wants to make us great again, great defined by being an empire again. And you can't be a Russian empire without Ukraine. As you know, going back for a long way, probably to Ivan the Terrible, the proper title for a czar was czar of all the Russias. What does all the Russias mean? Well, all the Russias means Russia. It means Belarus, which is just white Russia, and it means Ukraine. Because what's the Ukraine? It's in a way the birthplace of Rus, Russia. And secondly, it's also the outlands, the frontier of Russia. So you would see how Putin would want to see. He pretty much has Belarus. I think that under Lukashenko at this point, one can say that Belarus is essentially a vassal state and looks to the Kremlin and kisses Putin's ring. So he needs Ukraine. Now, after I don't think he'd be satisfied after that. First of all, I think he's a pan-Russianist, but he's probably a pan-Slavicist too. So various other Slavic countries he'd want included. And I think he dislikes, of course, the fact that the Baltic states, Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, have the temerity to declare themselves and to consider themselves independent. And there are Russian populations in those countries that he may say, as he has for Ukraine, we need to protect the Russian speakers, the ethnic Russians who are oppressed in these places. And then there's Kaliningrad. And it's very interesting because my son is right now, my son is a military officer, and he's posted in Latvia. And he's looking at the Baltics and trying to understand. And you can't get to the Russian possession of Kaliningrad, which used to be a Germanic province, like Königsberg, without going straight through Lithuania. Wouldn't Putin like to do that if he could?
To your point, the speeches that Vladimir Putin gave, the speech he gave on February 21st before the invasion, the speech he gave right after the invasion on February 24th, he actually spoke a lot, not about recreation of the Soviet sphere, but recreation of Russian imperialism. He had some pretty choice words for Joseph Stalin about how he gave too much autonomy, too much independent character to all these different provinces. And by doing so, he laid the groundwork for what we have now. And that's not how Russian empires will act.
That's right. I'm very much emphasized that it's the Russian empire that for which he pines, and not the Soviet empire, although he sees the Soviet empire as a modern incarnation of the Russian empire. But yes, he's very critical of decisions made, not least the idea of making this fiction that these were independent republics that were part of the Soviet Union, and of course, giving Crimea to Ukraine, which he thinks was a terrible, terrible error, which he has corrected in his view.
So with that as a backdrop, I have to ask, how do we break through here? In our last episode, I spoke with Jamie Fly, who's the president of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and he explained how Russia is increasingly what you might call a denied environment, in terms of Western information getting in, and in terms of the Russian people hearing messages from abroad. This is a huge challenge, obviously. because as Western media outlets leave Russia and as domestic sources of independent news dry up, there's nobody to counter the Kremlin narrative. Or is there?
Well, I think it's challenging. Look, I'm not a technological expert, but I would imagine that the United States should be ahead of everybody else technologically in every way, not least communications. So if there are satellite technologies that could provide, for example, VPNs to anybody with a computer easily, we should be doing that. Well, you know, when I was an exchange student there, when I was running around Africa, I had a shortwave radio the size of a bread box, and I would tune in. And Russians used to too. They would quietly go into a back room and tune in on that. You know, if what it takes is to recreate shortwave radio as a means of communicating with the average Russian and telling them the truth and breaking through the disinformation, well, we should do that. I mean, if you have to use high technology or use low technology, but you should get it done. I would urge Jamie and others to go to Congress and say, this is what we need in order to reach our audiences with a truthful message about what's happening in their countries and about the United States. That's our job.
And where do the Kremlin's war aims fit in here? Initially, when Putin talked about Ukraine, he talked about, quote unquote, demilitarization and denazification of Ukraine. But as the war has dragged on, he's changed his tune. And if anything, Russian officials now are thinking even bigger, they're talking even bigger. They're talking about some sort of existential conflict between Russia and the West. What are the implications here?
As we've discussed, I think what they wanted was from Ukrainians was submission, right? Submission. You remember there was a phrase Putin used early on. It was sort of a Russian folk saying, Paslovitsa, it's your duty, my beauty. In other words, it's what a mujik, what a Russian peasant, 50 years old, might say to his 20-year-old bride. Now, I don't know if you saw this. There were posters that went up in places like Kyiv. It showed a beautiful Ukrainian girl. And next to her is Putin, but he's on his knees and his hands are tied behind his back. And she has a revolver and it's in his mouth. And she says to him, I am not your beauty. I think Putin actually didn't understand, maybe really honestly, because he's very isolated, didn't understand the extent to which there is Ukrainian patriotism and nationalism. And nobody probably in history, other than maybe Stalin, has done more to energize Ukrainian nationalism and patriotism. Stalin did it with the Holodomor, the enforced famine in the 1930s that killed millions of Ukrainians and made those who survived think that we do not want to be governed or ruled from the Kremlin. But now Putin has done this. Look, one thing to consider is there is a school of thought that if you have a problem, the best way to solve it is to make it bigger. And so Putin may be thinking of this, if Ukraine's not going to submit, maybe I make NATO submit. What can I do to accomplish that? Now, militarily, I'm not sure that he has the means to do that. I'm not sure that would be a smart thing to do, which doesn't mean he might not do it. Anyhow, you know, he should be running, as I understand it, running a bit low on military supplies. He's pulled back from Kyiv because he can't take the capital and is going to say, okay, let's just take the eastern regions, Donbass and Mariupol, and then let's take the coastline so we have a land bridge to Crimea. And if he could go all the way west to Odessa. So all that, I mean, and he would like to make Ukraine into a landlocked country, which would be entirely dependent on him and it would be poor forever. It would be dependent forever. It would, at least to Ukraine as a culture. In that case, there's a genocidal element. He's not going to kill every Ukrainian, though he's killed quite a few, but he's going to wipe out the concept of a Ukrainian nation. I'm not sure he can achieve that. And I'm not sure how strategically he expands, you know, if he attacks Latvia or Estonia, or Lithuania at this point, or Moldova. You know, can he do that and what happens? Again, just because it's not smart doesn't mean he won't do it. A lot of us think, wouldn't he have been smart to continue the salami tactics he began with in 2014, he takes the Crimea from Ukraine and he invades and begins to occupy Donbass and fortifies his ownership and occupation of the eastern regions by recognizing two independent republics there and pushes out the Ukrainian military. He might have succeeded at that, waits a couple of years, sees what happens, lets whatever sanctions fade. It's only a minor incursion, to quote Biden. Perhaps that's how it's seen by Europeans who need oil and gas and coal and other energy products and have become dependent on Russia for them. And then he does it again. But he didn't do that. He wanted the whole hog. Why? I think there are a few reasons. One is, you know, he's pushing 70. He's thinking, I don't have a whole lot of time to achieve the legacy I want. I think that's possible. Two, he sees Biden capitulate in Afghanistan. He thinks this guy doesn't want to fight. The Germans at that point were more dependent on him than ever. He thinks, you know, timing is everything. This is my moment. I think maybe he's not so well at this point physically. We've heard rumors that that may be the case, as you may know. So maybe for a lot of reasons, he said, no, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound, I'm going to do the whole thing. And that was probably a strategic mistake. But I emphasize, we don't yet know how this movie ends.
Okay, but the implications of all this extend far beyond Russia and Ukraine, because the conflict isn't taking place in a vacuum. What do you think other countries like China are taking away from the current course of the war, both positively and negatively? What are they seeing in terms of military operations, but also in terms of the effectiveness of disinformation and of propaganda?
Well, there's a number of things that we should at least mention. One is the possibility that Putin is failing in the sense that I think it's getting pretty clear that Finland now wants to join NATO and thinks being in NATO is better than being outside of NATO. And I think that could happen. And that would be a failure and a defeat for Putin. Sweden is also seriously talking about it. Sweden was even, you know, neutral in World War II. So, I mean, that's kind of an amazing thing. You know, Xi Jinping, it's a bit of a mystery. I do think it is really significant. On February 4th, Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin signed an agreement that said their alliance has, quote, no limits, I think is the phrase that was used. Now, my belief here, and I take this really, I've been persuaded by Matt Pottinger, who, as you know, was a deputy national security counsel in the last administration and was really the guy most responsible for convincing people, hey, we've been wrong about China for years, letting them into the WTO, making them a strategic partner, a stakeholder in the American-led liberal international order has, where he was the one who convinced that this is all nonsense. We're kidding ourselves. It ain't happening. And what he has been saying, and I wrote a column about this for the Washington Times, is that, look, a Cold War has been declared on us. It's not like our choice anymore. It's been declared. And it's Cold War II. And just as World War I wasn't exactly the same as World War II, but the similarities were, you know, quite significant, the same is true of Cold War I and Cold War II. Now, one important difference is in Cold War I, Russia was a senior partner, China the junior partner. In Cold War II, China is a senior partner, Russia is the junior partner. And there's a role being played, by the way, by the Islamic Republic of Iran, who is also in this group. So if this is a Cold War that's been declared upon us, we have to decide what to do about it. Do we capitulate? I hope not, but we might. Certainly that's the hope of our adversaries. Or we fight it. How do we fight it? Maybe a lot the way we fought Cold War I since we were kind of successful. But that means a lot of things. For example, probably means doubling our military budget to where it was during Cold War I. And China is a more formidable adversary militarily, economically, and probably ideologically as well than Russia ever was. It's going to be a more challenging time. Here's the question that I'm having trouble answering is how Xi Jinping views what's going on with Ukraine. Does he think, oh, that stupid Putin doesn't know what he's doing, I never should have gotten in bed with him? Or does he think, no, I've got to help him, he's got to win this, I'm going to supply him with whatever he needs. This is what allies are for. We're not like the Americans. We don't abandon our allies in hard times. We need to show that to the world because America has shown its weakness, and that has ramifications that are helpful to us and bad for America. But I don't know what Xi Jinping thinks. I'm not smart enough. Matt Pottinger probably has more clues, and I can think of a few other people who do. Matt is working with us, as you may know, with FDD as chairman of our Asia program. So he's just a brilliant and intriguing guy, and you should definitely talk to him if you haven't.
Well, I'll have to ask him that question. And the other one, the adjacent one that I'll ask, obviously, is that all politics are local, as they say, and what the Chinese are looking at when they're looking at Russia having so much difficulty with Ukraine, has to be Taiwan. It has to be considerations about whether a reunification of Taiwan, as the Chinese talk about it, is feasible or it could carry some adverse consequences they hadn't thought of previously.
Yeah, this is a very interesting question, and it's something I've been giving some thought to and actually just been writing something about. You know, we as Americans sometimes have difficulty understanding the predicament of nations that live in neighborhoods with big bad bullies, because we have an ocean on either side, and we have, you know, rather weak neighbors to the north and south. But Xi Jinping believes that the people of Taiwan have no right to decide who rules them. He's not going to say, let's have a plebiscite. I think they'd rather be ruled by me here in Beijing. He says, no, we have the right. We are entitled to rule the people of Taiwan, whether they want it or not. It's your duty, my beauty. It's the same thing that Putin says for Ukraine. It's what Saddam Hussein said about Kuwait in 1990. But Bush said this will not stand and pushed him out. Kim Jong-un, you know, is just itching to subjugate the people of South Korea. He would do so if we didn't have American troops there. And a slightly different example, slightly different, is the Islamic Republic of Iran vis-a-vis Israel. Why is it slightly different? For this reason. Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader, he doesn't want the Israelis to submit to him as the Chinese do to the Taiwanese, as the Russians do to the Ukrainians. He wants them to perish. What was supposed to stop this idea of big bully nations conquering, occupying, invading, occupying, taking over their neighbors was we had this international order that was supposed to mean you don't cross a border and just wipe a nation off the earth. You just don't do that, because we have international law and we have international norms. Except guess what? We don't. Because Russia and China are on the Security Council and have a veto, and they don't believe in any of that when it comes to them. And so this, what this should tell us is a whole lot about the UN and the international order and the chimera that the international community really is. And that should have ramifications if anybody's thinking strategically about America's role in the world and what America should be doing and must do. But what I'm really trying to say is what's going on in Ukraine right now, and this gets back to your question, yes, it has ramifications for what Xi Jinping will do to Taiwan and what other countries will do around the world to their neighbors once they understand whether there are rules or there are no rules in the world, whether we are totally, in fact, in a jungle rather than in some kind of international order.
And I think that's a great place to end, because you're absolutely right. The war of narratives that we see between the West and Russia, between Ukraine and Russia, is also a war of narratives about the shape of the future global order, about what norms are acceptable, what norms are enforced, what are the rules of the road. And so this is a very high stakes tug of war. It's a tug of war that's taking place on the airwaves. It's a tug of war that's taking place on the battlefield in Ukraine. But I think you're right. It's enormously consequential.
Yeah, and I'll just make this one more point and why this is so historically important. Because after World War II, what did the U.S. try to do and what did it say? It said, we're not going to be an empire. We're going to lead. We're going to find common ground even with our adversaries. There are certain things that are going to be beyond the pale. We can all agree upon. And this is a better way. This is a better international order than we've ever had before if we can maintain it. And what Russia and China and Iran are saying is, no, we make the rules. And what you should do is back down. And it's really, and it's important also because there are those here in the United States, both on the right and the left, who I would call isolationists, they won't like the term, who are sort of saying, yeah, let that happen. What do we care? It doesn't matter to us. Again, we have oceans and on either side and Canada to the north. And why does this, you know, it just doesn't matter to us. And there are those on the left who also say, yeah, we got many more important things to do, student debt, and we have things to pay for. We don't need to pay for a strong military. And therein some serious dangers lie.
Well, let's leave it there. Cliff, thanks so much for taking the time.
My pleasure. Talk to you soon.
Thank you for tuning in to Disinformation Wars. To learn more about the American Foreign Policy Council and our work on public diplomacy, visit us online at www.afpc.org. And as always, we hope you'll join us again next time.